Coming up, Christians in Iraq. Ongoing violence has forced hundreds of thousands of them to flee the country. And Abraham Verghese, the physician and popular writer who sees his work as a ministry of healing. Plus, a poet's take on the Psalms and how they address every human emotion from despair to jubilation.
The Psalms are full of longing for God, you know, a longing to experience God more intimately.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Kim Lawton, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Thank you for joining us. Pope Benedict XVI set off a new global conversation this week about the use of condoms to help stop the spread of HIV/AIDS. In a new book, the Pope said in certain situations, using a condom to prevent the transmission of a deadly disease could be a step toward moral responsibility. He cited the example of a prostitute. The Catholic Church has long opposed condoms as a means of birth control, but there has been strong internal debate about their use in AIDS prevention. In 2009, Benedict said he believes condoms can increase the problem of HIV/AIDS. And again in this book, Benedict said that condoms aren't a real solution to the AIDS crisis. The Vatican said Benedict's comments are not a change in church teaching on immoral sexual behavior. But there has been intense speculation about exactly what the Pope meant and how it might affect the fight against AIDS. The new book is called Light of the World. It's based on a series of Benedict's interviews with a German journalist and covers a host of topics, from the clergy sex abuse scandal to theology and relations with Muslims, Protestants, and Jews. There are personal insights as well. For example, Benedict said he likes to relax with members of his private household, whom he calls his papal family, and watch old Italian movies. In this country, an interfaith coalition gathered on Capitol Hill this week to call the government's attention to the needs of the poor. At a meeting that included administration and congressional staff, faith leaders urged new efforts to reduce poverty by half over the next 10 years.
There are now more people in this nation poor than at any time in the 51 years for which such statistics have been kept. That is simply unconscionable. It is unacceptable to people of faith, and we need to say so, and we need to say so now.
The coalition also called for immediate passage of the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Act. The holiday shopping season kicks off this week, but many Americans say they'll be buying fewer gifts this year. According to a new survey from the Christian group World Vision, 7 in 10 Americans say they will cut back on holiday spending because of the current economy. And about half say they're more likely to give a charitable gift as a present. Religious leaders have called for special prayers this weekend for Haiti, where the cholera epidemic continues to spiral. Evangelist Franklin Graham, head of the faith-based relief group Samaritan's Purse, says the number of cholera deaths has been vastly underreported. He urged the U.S. military to begin emergency airlifts of relief supplies, and he called on Haitian authorities to expedite the bureaucratic customs process. In the past several weeks, there's been a series of attacks against Christians in Iraq. The most tragic, a siege against a Catholic church in Baghdad, where at least 58 people were killed. Many Iraqi Christians say the violence actually began after the U.S. invasion in 2003, when extremists turned against them, forcing hundreds of thousands to flee. Kate Seeley has our report on the exodus of Christians from Iraq.
In a church in the Iraqi village of Karakosh, a priest prepares for a communal baptism. With a splash of water, he welcomes these infants into the Christian faith. It's a challenging time for Iraq's Christians. Since the 2003 American invasion, the Christian community has been threatened and persecuted. Everyone is a target, including Father Mazen Ishu Matoka. His church in the city of Mosul has been bombed 3 times. He himself was kidnapped and held for 9 days. But the real horror took place last February when his parents responded to a knock at their Mosul home.
My father opened the door and saw three armed people. They entered the house, and my brother tried to resist them, but he had no weapons. We don't keep weapons at home.
The intruders asked for an identity card to confirm that the family was Christian. They then shot and killed the priest's father and two brothers. Father Mazen says the killings make no sense to him.
Are they political or sectarian? Is this part of some plan to get rid of the Christians? There is always a question mark. Nobody claims the assassinations.
Iraq's Christians are one of the world's oldest Christian communities. Most belong to the Chaldean Catholic Church. Others are Assyrian, affiliated with the Church of the East, or Syriac Orthodox. While they all speak Arabic, their native tongue is Aramaic, the language of Christ. At the time of Saddam Hussein's overthrow, there were estimated to be up to 1 million Christians in Iraq. Today, their numbers have diminished by more than a third as Christians have fled a wave of violence unleashed by the U.S. invasion. Siham and Linda Bashir are widows. Their husbands, a father and son, were killed in 2008. The men were shot within 2 weeks of each other in Mosul by unidentified gunmen. The widows blame the violence on growing Muslim extremism and intolerance, which they say didn't exist before the U.S. invasion.
During the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, we sent food and well wishes to the Muslims. Muslims visited Christians, Christians visited Muslims. We all got along. But after the collapse of Saddam, everything changed.
In the past, they say, Iraq's Christians were an accepted and integral part of Iraqi society. Their contributions were significant, adds Bazil George Kazmusa, the Syriac Archbishop of Mosul.
In the 1950s, the dozens of doctors in Mosul were all Christian. Christians opened the first schools, the first publishing house, the first theater, the first hospital.
Most importantly, he adds, Christians were secure and protected under Saddam Hussein's government. But the arrival of American troops put the community in a difficult position, adds Kazmusa.
The Christians suffered from the advent of the Americans because our Muslim brothers assumed that because they were Christians and we were Christians, we must be allies. So we had to defend ourselves against that.
Christians were not a part of the Iraqi opposition to Saddam, unlike most Kurds and Shia Muslims. But once he was overthrown, many Christians took jobs with the American army. As law and order dissolved in the new Iraq, extremists filled the void. They accused Christians of being traitors, attacking their churches and businesses, and demanded that they convert to Islam. Without a militia to protect them, Iraq's Christian community started to flee. Some came here to this largely Christian village of Karakosh, where security is tight. Karakosh is located in the Nineveh Plains, just north of Mosul, in the northern part of Iraq. Because it's so secure, Karakosh has largely been spared the violence plaguing big cities like Mosul and Baghdad. Since 2005, nearly 10,000 Christians have fled here. This hastily erected compound houses hundreds of refugees, like the Bashirs, who say they're just scraping by.
The government has never given us anything, but there are a few humanitarian organizations which sometimes give us food, clothes, and money.
But the vast majority of Christian refugees have fled Iraq altogether and are living in neighboring countries like Jordan and Syria. Christian leaders here are now debating how to keep the remaining members of their community from leaving. Some hope a new election law giving Christians a minimum of 5 seats in Iraq's parliament will increase their influence. Other leaders have been talking about establishing a so-called safe zone for Christians in the Nineveh Plains. But Luis Marcos, a local council member in Karakosh, says it's a bad idea.
An autonomous zone would be a risky solution for the Christians because many other groups oppose it. And if the Christians bring this issue up again, there will be more threats and killings and migrations.
Instead, Marco says he would welcome U.S. and foreign aid to create jobs here, as well as to establish local police units manned by Christians. He says better local security is critical, especially given a growing dispute in the Nineveh Plains between Arabs and Kurds, a separate ethnic group. Marco says the Kurds, who run a semi-autonomous region to the north, lay claim to parts of Nineveh, even though it's under the jurisdiction of Iraq's central government.
We live in an area that is disputed. We have our brothers, the Kurds, to the north, and to the south, our brothers, the Arabs. In Nineveh, we are stuck in the middle, caught between a rock and a hard place.
Lawyer Hani Andrews says, given all the pressures his community faces, Christians see no future for themselves in Iraq.
Every Assyrian Christian single man or woman wants to leave the country if they get this chance. Yes. In general, if now, for example, if the United States administration declares that we are ready to give visas, U.S. visas, to go to United States for Christians in Iraq, I think at least 80% of what we have left of our population will leave the country to United States.
And what will that mean for the Christian community?
We are persecuted. We have been killed every day.
But what will that mean for the numbers of Christians in Iraq? Will there be any Christians left?
No, of course. The population is rapidly decreasing, and most of them want to flee.
Hani adds that the disappearance of Iraq's Christians would not be unprecedented. He points to neighboring Turkey, where a once flourishing Christian community is now virtually non-existent. He says Christians in places like Egypt and Palestine are also leaving due to political pressures.
If these superpowers will stay ignoring what's happening in the Middle East, I think in the next 50 or 70 years, the Middle East will be empty from Christianity.
For Iraq's Christian community, which traces its roots as far back as ancient Mesopotamia, it's a bitter prospect. But the only real guarantee for its safety is a secure and democratic Iraq. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Kate Seeley in Iraq.
We have a profile now of Abraham Verghese, a doctor, popular writer, teacher, and advocate of the idea that the practice of medicine is a calling. Fred DeSam Lazaro spoke to him.
Abraham Verghese has all the credentials and degrees befitting a professor at Stanford Medical School, but he's best known and acclaimed for his writing, two best-selling memoirs, and a new work of fiction that evoke a different kind of medical vocation.
My desire to be a physician had a lot to do with that sense of medicine as a ministry of healing, not just a science, and not even just a science and an art, but also a calling, also a ministry.
His goal is to have today's medical students aspire similarly to a calling as much as a career in medicine, to awaken a more basic curiosity as they sharpen their clinical acumen. These third-year medical students were studying abnormalities on a scan, specifically the prominence of certain blood vessels.
This is what's called pulmonary redistribution. Have you heard that term? It's an early sign of heart failure. Who's got good hand veins that I can borrow?
Verghese offered a simple physics explanation of why blood vessels should not normally be visible above the level of the heart.
The level of her right atrium is about here. Okay? So watch what happens as I raise her hand. You still see the veins? Nice three dimension, right? See how they're flattening out?
Cool.
And they are gone.
The bottom line, well before an x-ray, a doctor might spot telltale signs of disease.
And you see their neck veins, and they're not coughing, speaking, singing, straining. They have increased venous pressure.
Increasingly, he says, students and practitioners of medicine in the West rely on technology in a system that stresses cognitive knowledge and machines over the skill that comes from touch and feel.
I'm the first to admit that the resolution of a hand feeling the belly doesn't compare with the resolution of a CAT scan scanning the belly. But only my hand can say that it hurts at this spot and not at this spot. Only my hand can say that. Only my hand can say that this pulsatile mass, which might be an aneurysm, is also painful, which is therefore maybe a leaking aneurysm. You know, there are nuances to the exam that no machine is going to give you.
It's a theme Verghese has sounded repeatedly over the years, writing in magazines including The New Yorker and Atlantic, and now in a bestseller called Cutting for Stone. it fulfills a long-held desire to write fiction, as he told this book club in Menlo Park, California.
Dorothy Allison, a wonderful American writer, she says, "Fiction is the great lie that tells the truth about how the world lives."
The setting for Verghese's novel is far from Silicon Valley, a mission hospital in Ethiopia. It is a textured 650-page narrative set amid that country's turmoil in the 60s and 70s. Its stories of medicine, doctors, and future doctors at the hospital all illustrate what the author calls the Samaritan role of the healer. Verghese went from med school in India to Boston, Tennessee, Texas, then Stanford. He was born and raised in Ethiopia to parents originally from Kerala, India, and from its Syriac Orthodox traditions. Faith was a big part of life for this and other expatriate communities in the Addis Ababa of his youth, which may unwittingly have shaped some of the novel's characters.
You said that what really inspired you to write the book was you wanted to write a book that would get people interested perhaps in medicine.
Yeah.
But there was so much in the book about faith.
Yes.
And different types of faith. And so how did you come to have so much of this, of another theme in your book?
Well, you know, the honest answer is I don't really know. It just sort of all evolved that way. And I think when you're in medicine, you agonize over matters of faith.
The confluence of faith and medicine and the Mission Hospital itself attracted Duke University Divinity School Dean Gregory Jones to Verghese's book. It was a timely find just before a recent trip to discuss his church's own mission work.
It becomes a shaping institution that plays a really significant role in any developing country, and one that we need to pay a lot more attention to. My trip to London was actually to deal with issues around southern Sudan. And so I was struck by the significant role this hospital was playing in the novel about Ethiopia.
And even though its setting seems distant, Jones says the novel's context is very relevant to many students he sees at Duke.
I think a lot of Christians go into nursing or medicine or other health-related vocations out of a deeply formed and felt Christian vocation, but sometimes the practice of healthcare in the United States particularly often pushes those apart. And I think the novel portrays that in a really beautiful way.
I joke, but only half joke, that if you show up in an American hospital missing a finger, no one will believe you till they get a CAT scan, MRI, and orthopedic consult.
All the emphasis on machines, he says, adds cost to the healthcare system and comes at the expense of one of our most important rituals, a visit with one's doctor.
Rituals are about transformation. You know, we marry with great ceremony to signal a transformation. We are baptized in a ritual to signal a transformation. The ritual of one individual coming to another and confessing to them things they wouldn't tell their spouse, their preacher, their rabbi, and then even more incredibly, disrobing and allowing touch, which in any other context would be assault. You know, tell me that that's not a ritual of great significance. If we shortchange the ritual by not being attentive or you're inputting into the computer while the patient's talking to you, you basically are destroying the opportunity for the transformation. And what is a transformation? It's the sealing of the patient-physician bond.
Ironically, Verghese says research is emerging that corroborates the importance of this bond, the virtue of the Samaritan healer.
We're learning that you can have a powerful effect on patients or a powerful negative effect on patients based on context, based on your tone of voice. They are actually associated with significant chemical changes in the brain. The Parkinson's patient's dopamine levels go up with a placebo. We're now able to show that the words of comfort trigger biological reactions, which are the very things that you want. And you can use drugs to get there, or you can use words of comfort to get there, which would make your drugs so much more effective. It's an incredible insight in, you know, a couple of decades now of practicing medicine. It's lovely to come full circle to where I started, but with the science to back it up.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSamlazaro.
Over the centuries, people have had different, often deeply personal reactions to reading the Psalms. Boston poet and writer Pamela Greenberg, who's Jewish, says at a dark point in her life, she found so much comfort in the Psalms, she wanted to translate them from the original Hebrew into poetic language for people of all faiths. Her book is called The Complete Psalms. And by the way, our story is illustrated with illuminated manuscripts of the Psalms by artist Deborah Band.
I began the translation at a very dark time in my life. I came to religion as an adult, really as an act of desperation. You know, I felt I needed to believe in something, and I struggled with depression. I had an intuition that in the Psalms, I would find something of the relationship to God that I was looking for. The Psalms are full of longing for God, you know, a longing to experience God more intimately. I think mostly for Christians, the Psalms represent exactly what they do for Jews, which is the person of faith standing up in relation to God in a very honest and genuine way. And I think in that way they speak to all of us. The great thing about the Psalms is they address really the whole spectrum of human emotion, from intense despair and feelings of abandonment by God, feelings of betrayal by humankind, fear of mortality, to great joy and jubilance. And when I walk through the valley overshadowed by death, I will fear no harm, for you are with me. In translating Psalm 23, I was very aware that it is a psalm that people are most familiar with. And so I wrestled with it. It seemed to me to be a psalm that addressed the fear of mortality. And it's about death, but it's really about, it's for the people who are living. And it's also about the kind of spiritual death that we experience in our lives, distance from God. The Psalms are very important to people who are suffering, because illness can leave us feeling very distant and cut off from God. And for people to feel that there's a way to talk to God, even from those periods of intense, almost unbearable torment, was very transformative. To my mind, anger at God is a part of religious life. In Psalm 39, for instance, the psalmist is saying, I am getting ready to walk away from you. My interaction with you brings only pain and sorrow. You know, answer me before I leave. And to me, that's religious speech. I did wrestle with, I would say particularly with the concept of the enemy in the Psalms, Psalm 109, verse 8, which is a psalm that wishes destruction upon the enemy, and in very vivid terms. And that kind of thing terrifies me. You do find within the Psalms wishes for revenge upon the enemy. In my understanding, those expressions are really meant to diffuse the kind of human anger that we experience by articulating them, by placing that revenge in the hands of God rather than in human hands. The Psalms are very much concerned with justice, while at the same time looking around the world and seeing the injustice of the world and crying out to God, saying, you know, God, you who created the heavens and earth, why can't you create justice on earth? The Psalms that praise God are also important because they situate joy within the context of a relationship with God, which makes joy more than simply moments of happiness within a person's life, but it sort of gives joy a more of an eternal context. The ending of the book of Psalms is a crescendo of praise. You know, the very last psalm, Psalm 150. Praise God with cymbals that ring loudly. Praise God with cymbals that come crashing down. Let everything that breathes praise God. Shine forth your praises on God.
Finally, on our calendar, the season of Advent begins on Sunday for Western Christians and some branches of Eastern Orthodoxy. It's a time of spiritual preparation for Christmas, and for many Christians, it's also the beginning of the new church year. And for Jews, Hanukkah begins this week. The eight-day festival marks the time when Jews recaptured the temple in Jerusalem in the 2nd century B.C. According to tradition, the Jews lit lamps in the temple with only a one-day supply of oil, but the candles burned for 8 days. That's our program for now. I'm Kim Lawton. There's much more on our website, including more of our interviews with Abraham Verghese and Pamela Greenberg. You can comment on all of our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. You can follow us on Twitter and on Facebook, where I have a fan page now, too. You can also watch us on smartphones and iPhones. To find out more, join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, mariachi music from Mexico in honor of Saint Cecilia, the patron saint of musicians.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.